5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Have you ever been in love? If you have, you know what it feels like. It's a force stronger than any logical reasoning. We are swept and thrashed by it like a wooden ship trying to fight a furious ocean storm. And even if we survive the storm, we shall take massive damage, and the wreck inside lasts for the rest of our lives. But if you are lucky, if you are truly blessed, you meet the one who is willing to love you in all your wretchedness. They refuse to jump ship, even when they see you for the revolting creature you truly are. Forgive my sentimentality. I'm a romantic man. I grew up in Chile, a small country at the very south of the world, thin and narrow, with the driest desert in the world, and to its north and glaciers so pure and white in the south that they seem to glow a bluish hue. The culture there is a mix of European traditions as well as Andean Amerindian superstitions. So when something truly magical happens, it feels like something ordinary. Isn't that how most of us treat love? We treat something magical as if it were mundane. Many mysterious things have happened to my family and to myself, and this one happened in the early 20th century. To one of my great-granduncles, who was a sailor near the small town of Constitución, 6 hours south of the capital city, Santiago de Chile. My uncle loved the sea. He loved the illusion of freedom that traveling from port to port gave him. A woman and a story in every port, they said back then. Never settling down, he truly was a ladies' man and a heartbreaker, but he was also admired by his mates, as they considered him an alpha. He was tall and strong, with a physique naturally built by manual labor, the kind of guy you want on your corner during a fight. He did love the ocean, and sometimes his mates would find him alone in the middle of the night by the edge of the ship, grabbing onto the rail as if contemplating to jump into the water. His gaze lost in the dark, unseen distance. And when one of his closest mates would ask him what he was doing there in the middle of the night, he would tell them he was listening to the singing. It was so beautiful. His mates couldn't hear anything, and they thought he was pranking them. But this happens too many times for it to just be a prank, so maybe he truly heard something calling out to him from the distant horizon deep at sea. Who knows? My uncle wasn't a sentimental man like me. Instead, he enjoyed a good party and a stiff drink. And every time him and his mates arrived at a new port, they would walk the streets like a pack of wolves, hunting for defenseless lambs, looking for the most beautiful girls to keep them company. And my uncle, being a handsome man, always got first pick. Even though he had the prettiest girls around him, he still felt like they were missing something. So after he had his fun with them, he didn't stay to hold them or get to know them. He would go to the shore and stare into the distance, as if that voice calling out to him from the depths gave him more fulfillment than the touch of a beautiful woman. One of those nights, while my uncle sat by the shore of the beach, gazing into the distance, after having his way with a couple of local girls, he spotted something in the water. skin so white it glowed silvery under the full moon, hair so long like seaweed as it hung wet down her body. And when she turned around, he saw her face. Perfect. It was perfect. The most beautiful face he had seen. And he had seen lots of pretty girls, but there's a difference between pretty and beautiful. And this girl was beautiful. He couldn't control himself. He couldn't help it. He had to see her up close. So fully clothed, he stepped into the water. The waves were up to his waist. And as he got closer to her, he saw she was even more beautiful than he thought earlier. She turned to look back at him and held his gaze. She was naked, only covered by her long hair that looked dark green under the full moon, like seaweed on the rocks. And he couldn't help himself. He touched her silvery white skin. She was so cold, but felt so soft. She didn't seem scared of him. I didn't try to run away. Instead, she signaled for him to come closer, and before he could embrace her, she embraced him, kissed him, and held on to him. She was so cold, colder than a person should be, but she didn't shiver at all, and he enjoyed her embrace. They didn't exchange words, only kisses and embraces there in the shallow of the beach. And as they kissed and held each other tenderly, my uncle noticed that they were getting deeper into the water. Now the waves were up to his neck, but he didn't worry. He was a good swimmer, and being with this most beautiful girl was worth the risk. But this moment didn't last for too much longer. Soon, my uncle's mates were yelling from the shore, calling out to him. And as he shouted back at them, it was time to get back to the ship. But he couldn't leave her there. He begged her to come with him. For the first time ever, he wanted to know a woman as more than an adventure. She told him she couldn't go with him this time, but she would find him again, she promised him, that she'd always find him. So with this reassurance that he wouldn't lose what he never knew he needed, he got out of the water and walked to the beach, soaked and heavy, but lighthearted, all smiles. His mates teased him for letting a girl get him into that shape, but he didn't care. She was special, and he turned around to look back at her and wave, but she had already left the beach, so he could only hope she kept her word. The very next day, while my uncle and his mates were out in the town, walking the outdoors market by the port, with a mixture of stands selling fruits and vegetables, second-hand goods, antiques, and artisan jewelry, etc. My uncle saw the beautiful woman. She was wearing a simple white dress that fit loosely around her body, and her hair was lighter than he remembered it. A beautiful ash blonde instead of the green that the full moon and salt water seemed to cast on her the night before. And she was fair-skinned, but not nearly as pale and silvery as under the full moon, but that face was extraordinarily beautiful, as he remembered. He went to her, holding her hand and leaving his mates behind, walking along the port and seawall with her, asking about her and where she came from, as he had never done with other girls. But she didn't like talking about herself. Instead, she wanted to know all about him, about his travels and his adventures, and he told her as she listened attentively and wide-eyed. It was almost sunset, and he had to go report to the ship, but he asked to see her that night, and she said yes. As my uncle walked back to port, an old gypsy woman walked behind him, waddling behind him as she held herself together with a cane. He had seen her earlier selling artisan crafts at the outdoors market, and he stopped to look at her and see if she needed help. But instead, when she got up to him, she grabbed his wrist and squeezed tightly. With tears and fear in her eyes, she said, "Not her. Leave alone." The woman had a thick Eastern European accent, obviously didn't speak much English, So my uncle stood there trying to understand what the woman wanted, and she repeated, "Not her. Leave alone." My uncle just looked at the old gypsy lady as she repeated, "Leave alone. Mahrime." As she spat on the floor 3 times, still tightly squeezing his wrist. My uncle pulled away from the old lady as she screamed, "Mahrime," at him, which is not a word he recognized, so he walked away from her and got back to the ship. My uncle met his beautiful lady again that night. He was curious about her, and she finally relented and told him she wasn't from the town. She had grown up used to traveling, and soon she'd get back home. Soon she'd need to leave, or she wouldn't be able to get back home, but that she'd always find him. He assumed that she must be a traveler, a gypsy, and perhaps that's why the old gypsy lady acted so strange with him, as a girl of the tribe isn't supposed to be with someone who is not a gypsy. My uncle barely knew this beautiful girl, but he thought himself in love with her, and with both of them traveling around, he feared he would lose her. So he begged her to stay with him and not go back home. But she couldn't do that. If she didn't leave by sunrise, she would not be able to go home. And he said he understood. But still, he planned to keep her with him. They found a little hotel in which they could spend the night together, and they made love for hours. He didn't want to leave her in silence after the climax, as he did with other girls. He wanted to hold on to her. He wanted her to be his wife. So after hours of lovemaking, he cuddled her, caressed her soft, fair skin, and stroking her beautiful blonde hair. He wrapped his arms around her all night. By morning, the beautiful girl had woken up before sunrise, and she tried to leave the bedroom so she could go home, as she had told my uncle she needed to do. But he held on to her, overpowering her with his strong body, and although she struggled against him and asked him to release her, he didn't let go. Instead, he kissed her and held her firmly, but gently, as if holding something extremely delicate, and for a moment he thought she could break in his arms as she struggled to break free from his embrace. But by sunrise, she surrendered. She cried so gently, and he thought she was even more beautiful when she was sad. She told him she had nowhere to go now, nowhere to call home. So my uncle told her she had him, and wanted her as his bride. He wanted to settle down with her, and he was in love with her. He promised her she had his heart. "My heart is yours, and as long as I live, you'll always have me, and we'll make a home together." She believed him. They bought a little house together, with the savings my uncle had, a cozy cabin overlooking the ocean, and they settled down. My uncle worked in town as a fisherman, and his beautiful lady kept their house, cooked for them, and always had a pleasant disposition for him when he arrived, tired after a long day. They were a happy couple living a simple life. But that's the thing about happiness. For many people, settling down and living a simple, happy life isn't enough. It wasn't for my uncle. He missed being a sailor, and just going out into the ocean to fish wasn't enough. He missed traveling and going to different ports, meeting new people and meeting new girls, even if the most beautiful one was waiting for him at home. A year had gone by, and he decided he would go back to being a sailor. He needed excitement in his life. He told the news to his beautiful bride, but she didn't take it well. He wanted to leave her already to go on adventures, while she had left everything behind to stay with him. He didn't understand what the big deal was. He would be gone for a few months, 6 or 8, but he would return. He would send her money to keep their house in order, and he'd come back in less than a year. She was heartbroken, but she let him go. She had met him a sailor, and she understood he wouldn't change for her as she had changed for him. My uncle was always a ladies' man, and old habits die hard. He still enjoyed a stiff drink or a few, He wasn't cut out to be a husband and a father or a householder. He needed to float around from shore to shore to feel alive. And thus, he was back to his old tricks. A new girl in every port while a lonely bride waited for him on the distant shore. 6 months went by. 8 months. And then a year. He was not back home within a year, as he had said. And he wasn't planning on going back just yet. And soon after, the letters and the money stopped, and his lonely bride was left stranded waiting for him on the distant shore. A year and a half later, my uncle was in Valparaiso, a beautiful port city about an hour west from the capital city of Santiago de Chile. And as always, he was surrounded by pretty girls and drunken sailors. He no longer heard anything calling out to him in the distant horizon. There was nothing anchoring him. He was swept around by his passions, and that's all he lived for. As he parted with his sailor mates and their pretty young female companions, another female figure entered the tavern. She wore a dirty and worn-out dress, stained gray, though at some time in the past it had been white. Her hair was a matted mess, as if coarse from salt water, and there were large bags under her eyes from so much crying.
"I found you," she cried. "I told you I would always find you."
She cried.
What are you doing here?"
said my uncle.
"I came for you. I haven't heard from you in months. I was so worried. I've missed you so much,"
cried the beautiful lady in such a pathetic state. "You shouldn't have come back for me. I'm not going back with you. I'm sorry," he said in a tone that almost showed embarrassment from his actions.
"But you promised,"
she cried as she grabbed him by the arm, but instead of embracing her and calming her down as he had done when they first met, he struck her. He hit her so hard she fell to the floor, blood dripping from her lip, and she cried loudly, humiliated. The drunken sailors and their whores laughed. No one came to her rescue. No one spoke on her behalf. She picked herself up and left the tavern. My uncle didn't go after her as he should have, as an honorable man would have done. Instead, he kept drinking and playing games with the little harlots he had been acquainted with. Later that night, when my uncle and his sailor mates returned to the ship, she was waiting for him by the shore.
"What do you want now?"
asked the drunken fool who couldn't appreciate something precious.
"I just want what belongs to me. I came to collect what you said is mine."
She spoke with an emotionless, empty voice. His drunken friends laughed at her, and he asked them to leave so he could talk to this crazy broad. So they left him alone with his former lady by the rocky shore. No one knows exactly what happened after, but my uncle didn't return to the ship. And for days after, there was a search for him and his former bride. Eventually, they found his sailor uniform on the rocks, along with a torn, stained dress she wore. A few days later, they found him. He was floating face down, livid flesh and swollen as those who die drowning at sea end up, disfigured almost beyond recognition. But that was not all. His chest was ripped open, not a cut made by a knife, but something blunt that tore his flesh. His heart was gone, and his insides were all torn to chunks, or perhaps eaten. They never found his bride. To this day, small towns across the Chilean seashore tell stories about the Lady of the Sea, a beautiful woman who bathes nude in the ocean during the full moon. You can look at her from afar, but never get too close. It's said many young men don't heed this warning and are so enchanted by her beauty they must touch her. Those poor fools are found drowned and disfigured. their hearts devoured, eaten from the inside out by fish. It's easy to let yourself believe that there's no such thing as a community anymore. With everyone tied to their online identities and social circles, neighbors often remain strangers, only coming together by chance or tragedy. I sure as hell didn't plan on getting to know my neighbors when my family moved into our house. They didn't seem unfriendly, but I just didn't see the point in getting to know them. My wife and I had our own friends already, and our boys would rather play video games inside than get to know the other kids of the neighborhood. But as I said before, sometimes people are brought together. For us, it was tragedy. It happens before I got home from work. The crowd had dispersed and the ambulance was gone, but the drying blood still stained the sidewalk. I heard the story from my wife. A boy from across the street was walking home from school when a car swerved and ran him down. The boy's mother, who was sitting on the porch, watched it happen. Her screams brought everyone else out of their homes, and they called 911 while she cradled her son's broken body in her arms. The driver, an old man, had died of a heart attack while behind the wheel. An accident. The worst luck in the world. The kind of tragedy that fills you with an anger you can't blame on anyone. We all reached out to the mother, Miss Ramirez, in the wake of her son's untimely death, and to each other for support. We learned all of our neighbors' names in those weeks, started actually talking to one another, and suddenly this cold street became a real neighborhood for all of us. My family wasn't the first to leave flowers on the spot where the boy died, but we contributed. One of my brothers knew that Miss Ramirez was religious, so he used his allowance to buy a rosary, which he tied to the fence. No one was shy about showing their support during that first week, not until someone added an effigy to the memorial one Sunday morning. When it first appeared, it looked like a cross, two white wooden boards that were nailed together and bound the fence. I didn't bother to ask anyone about it, assuming that someone had seen my son's contribution and decided to add to it. The following morning, someone had nailed a third piece of wood to the top, giving it a stick figure-like appearance. I asked my wife if she knew who'd put it up, and she told me she had no idea. The third morning, the circle had a smiley face crudely drawn onto the surface, almost like a mockery of the boy's death. That started a conversation among the adults, who agreed that a child must have been behind it. We all asked our kids, but no one admitted to doing it. At this point, none of us were upset or irrationally mad, but it was unsettling to see the works of someone who seemed uniquely interested in reminding us that someone had died on our street. The final addition to the effigy was made on the fourth morning, as someone had dressed the stick figure in a white t-shirt. It looked almost like a scarecrow at this point, or maybe a ghost. When I got home from work that day, my wife told me that the boy's father, Lewis, had stopped by. He'd spoken with members of every family in the whole neighborhood, asking them to stop with the effigy if they were responsible. Apparently, it was upsetting Miss Ramirez. That evening, I watched from the living room window as Lewis took it down and rested it against the fence. The following morning, it was back up, secured to the fence with more rope than before. According to what my wife heard, Lewis had cut it down and thrown it in the trash. The next morning, the effigy was back. As I finished mowing my lawn, Lewis stopped by. "Who the hell's doing this?" he asked me. When I told him I didn't know, he pointed at the effigy. "I threw that thing away, and someone pulled it out of my trash. Do I have to burn the damn thing?" I glanced over at it from across the street, trying not to stare too long into its large black eyes. Whoever's doing this either doesn't know that it's upsetting you, or they're trying to upset you for some reason. Either way, they need to understand how you feel. If I were you, I'd take it back down and keep an eye out for who puts it back up. Lewis frowned.
You mean stalk the thing out? Like watch over the area overnight?
Yeah. I know it sounds strange, but I'll do it. With that, he crossed the street and used a pocket knife to cut away at the effigy's bindings. I didn't judge him, as I'm sure I would have done the same thing had my son died on that sidewalk.
I saw the smoke rising from his backyard later that afternoon. The effigy had been destroyed. The following morning, a week after the effigy first appeared, it was still gone. I went outside to grab the newspaper and saw that Lewis was sitting on his porch, pocket knife in hand, staring at the memorial. We shared a glance and a nod, and I went back inside. It happened that evening. Shortly after dark, while she was walking home, a woman who lived a few doors down from us was hit by a drunk driver. I ran outside when I heard the noise. It was Miss Allen. She was pinned against a telephone pole by the driver's van. At first glance, it looked like she was standing up, but her feet were a few inches off the ground. The driver was still unconscious when I approached them. I pulled him out of the car and kept him there while my wife called for an ambulance. He tried to get me to let him go, but I wouldn't let him leave. He told me that he had a family, and I informed him that she did too, telling him the names of Miss Allen's husband and children. That got him to stop talking. After telling the police what I'd witnessed, they thanked me for what I did and told me that I was free to go home. As I turned around to start walking back, I saw the effigy from the corner of my eye. I crossed the street and approached it, unable to truly process what I was looking at. The Ramirez boy was back, as though he'd never been taken down. He didn't look burned at all, but I could smell the smoke on him. Something told me that it wasn't a replacement, that this was the same effigy that Lewis had burned. It wasn't a guess. It was almost like intuition. I stared into the effigy's black eyes and knew that I'd stared into them before. The next morning, a second effigy had been nailed to the telephone pole. The face was slightly different, the eyes smaller and the smile a little thicker. In a way, it slightly resembled Miss Allen. Lewis took them both down and didn't bother bringing them into the backyard to burn them. He brought an oil drum to his driveway and threw both effigies inside them, setting them ablaze without saying a word to anyone. From what my wife overheard, he didn't even speak to Mr. Allen before doing so. The third death happened overnight, and no one noticed until the following morning. Near the end of the street, Mr. Harper was found just outside his house, nearly flattened on the sidewalk as though something had run him over. There were no tire tracks, but it looked like another vehicular accident. Nearby, a third effigy was already tied to the fence. Lewis came back, asking me what he should do next. I didn't have an answer for him. I wasn't exactly religious before this, but the deaths were making it easy to believe the impossible. At this point, it was clear that either our neighborhood had the worst luck of all time, or some force beyond a misguided or cruel person was responsible for the deaths. The connection to the effigies was clear, but I didn't know what it meant. Was it an apology? A signature? A knowing nod? I didn't know the answers, but I did know that I couldn't bear to look at the effigies anymore. If they were put up a year ago, I wouldn't know what they were for. Now I know all of the faces they resemble from memory, and all the names that go along with them. The fourth effigy came before the body did. A blank white cross was tied to the fence outside Lewis's house. I called him and told him about it, and I watched from my living room window as he made his way to the cross. He touched the cross and suddenly collapsed. By the time I ran to him, his body had been crushed by some invisible weight. It didn't even look like he'd been run over, more like something heavy had pulled him down and tried to flatten him against the ground. He died quickly, but not painlessly. I looked up, and a smiley face had appeared atop the cross. The effigies, I realized, weren't meant as memorials. They were warnings. By who? I had no idea. Since then, three more effigies have appeared, and three more neighbors had died. The city plans to put speed bumps on the streets, but that's not going to stop it. This morning, I woke to find a white cross left on the fence in front of my house. Without explaining why, I got my family into the car and drove to a hotel, making sure that no one was on the sidewalk as we drove past the cross. I'm going back tomorrow morning to begin packing my family's things. By now, someone else has died, and their effigy will be waiting for me. I'm sure I will recognize them, and even know their name. If a cross appears for me, I try to avoid it as best I can. If I fail to do so, or if an effigy appears in your neighborhood, then consider this as a much kinder warning than those I've been getting. And with that, I'll give you a piece of advice. Don't learn your neighbor's names, and don't let yourself become part of a community. A stranger's death is a far more shallow cut.